Well, it's a pleasure to be back in Aberdeen, and an encouragement to see a few well-known faces in the audience. It's also my privilege to share these meetings with Andrew. We've not been together before, although we did meet up in a coffee shop in Bristol. And I'm indebted to Andrew for the very helpful divisions that he has given of this letter of Paul to Timothy. It's his work, and the credit goes to him for that help. Now, this afternoon, the subject matter is sizing up the man of God. What we're going to do is simply acquaint ourselves with the man to whom this second epistle was written. It's going to be a very simple character study, but I hope that we can draw some valuable lessons from it. To begin, we'll read in Acts 16. Acts chapter 16. And there we just want to read the first three verses, Acts 16, verses 1, 2 and 3. Paul is now on his second missionary journey, and it says, "Then came he to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there, named Timotheus, the son of a certain woman which was a Jewess and believed, but his father was a Greek, which was well reported of by the brethren that were at Lystra and Iconium. Him would Paul have to go forth with him, and took and circumcised him because of the Jews which were there in those quarters, for they knew all that his father was a Greek." Now over to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, and there we're reading from verse 19 down to verse 22. "But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timotheus shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's, but ye know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he has served with me in the gospel." Now finally, to 2 Timothy chapter 1. And there we just want to read the fifth verse. Verse 5, 2 Timothy chapter 1. Paul says, "When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois, and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also." To help us in this character study, I want to think with you of Timothy in three ways. I want to think, first of all, of his divided home. Then we're going to spend time thinking of his delicate health. And then finally, I want to think with you of his developing holiness. Now I want to emphasize there's going to be nothing profound this afternoon, but I do hope that we'll be able to extract some practical points that will be of help and stimulus to all of us. His divided home, his delicate health, and his developing holiness. Let's think first of all of his divided home. You know, if you were to be selective in the scriptures that you read about Timothy, you would think that he had an idyllic background. Timothy was somebody who, from his infancy, and we'll think about this in another session, from a child, and the word there is infant, from an infant, thou hast known the holy letters. What a start to life. And he also had a godly heritage, because in the verse that we just read from chapter 1 of the second letter, there was a pedigree in that home. There was a mother and there was a grandmother, and Paul says they were characterized by unfeigned faith. And so it would seem on the surface of it that Timothy had the best of all possible starts to Christian life. But that, fellow saint, is not the full picture. Whereas Paul could speak of his mother and his grandmother and speak of their unfeigned faith, there's only 5 words recorded in the Holy Scriptures about his dad. Only 5. His father was a Greek. That's all it says. It's repeated, but that's all it says. His father was a Greek. And therefore, I do not feel that we have any ground to think that Timothy's father was a Christian. There's no commendation of his faith. There's nothing stated about Timothy's father and his service for the Lord. And I would assume that Timothy's father was never saved. And thus it is that his background wasn't ideal. He was brought up in a divided home. It was divided culturally. His mother was a Jewess, but his father was a Greek. But not only was it divided culturally, it was divided spiritually. His mother was a Jewess and believed, but his father was a Greek. I want to stop there. I just want to make some practical observations. And I want to appeal for a moment to those of you who are not married. Now, don't automatically think that that relates to the young people. I took a wedding in September of a couple, and the bridegroom was 75 and the bride was 78, and she had never been married before. You know, there is nothing wrong, and I'm not trying to be trite here, there's nothing wrong in anyone of any age wanting to be married. It's a perfectly natural and normal thing. But I do want to appeal to you, to those of you that want to be married. On a human level, you will never make a more significant, a more vital decision than who you will marry. I want to say this afternoon, it trumps every other decision. It's more important than where you work. It's more important than where you live. There is nothing on a human level comparable to the decision that will be made as to who you will marry. You know, fellow saint, there are some wonderful examples in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, of a husband and a wife that were compatible spiritually. I'm thinking of the parents of Moses, Amram and Jochebed. I'm thinking of the parents, you know, of John the Baptist, Zacharias and Elizabeth. I'm thinking of Priscilla and Aquila, maybe a childless couple. But you know, these couples and others, they pull together. They share the same values. They were committed to the same things. At one time, I actually wish some of these things weren't recorded. But at one time, my son was in a Baptist church, and he was going out with a girl that was in an assembly. And I sat down with my son on one occasion and said, "You know that this is not ideal, don't you?" Now, I thank God for that Baptist church. I was telling Ian and Jeanette on the way here. That Baptist church was the making of my son. But to have one going to one place and another going to another, fellow saint, at the very least, that's not ideal. At the very least. What a wonderful privilege it is, and there will be those in this room this afternoon that know more about this even than me and longer than me. What a wonderful privilege it is to have a wife or a husband and you share together spiritual values and spiritual convictions. But you know, if to be married to the right person is a great blessing, to be married to the wrong person is a tragedy. Now, I don't know why Eunice married Timothy's father. I have no idea as to the circumstances. Was she saved before she was married? Was she saved after she was married? I'm not sure that the Bible makes that clear. But there was an incompatibility between them. You know, God warned the children of Israel that they were not to marry the wives from the nations around them. And I do earnestly want to appeal to those of you that are looking for a husband or you're looking for a wife. In God's name, I appeal to you. Ensure that you're moving in the current of the will of God. You know, it was many years ago now that I was looking for a wife. And God gave me something. It's verses that are utterly out of their context. I appreciate that. But God gave me these verses. That was a great help to me. You remember when sin came into Eden, and God starts to challenge Adam and to Eve. And when he came to Adam, this is what Adam said. He said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me." Now what Adam was really doing was saying to God, "It's partly your fault." But that's not the point. Adam could look at his wife and he could say to God, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me." In the process of time, she had a child. And again, I'm lifting out from its setting what she meant. But she said, in the language of the Authorized Version, "I have gotten a man from the Lord." I want to say to you, sisters, that if you're contemplating or about to get married, you need to be able to say, "I've gotten a man from the Lord." You know, we often hear the expression, the unequal yoke. It's found in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And strictly speaking, that chapter's got nothing to do with marriage. But by application, the incompatibility of a saved and an unsaved person, there is no common ground. And Paul spells it out very clearly in that section. And I'm just appealing this afternoon that if you're about to take that step, that you're able to say that you're marrying in the Lord. But can I just take it a wee bit further? I want to speak to you who are younger now, those of you who are living at home with your parents. What a privilege it is to be brought up in a Christian home, where mother and father, where mam and dad love the Lord and teach you the scriptures, and they have a real interest in your spiritual well-being. What a tremendous privilege. But you know, maybe you don't quite see it as that. I have to admit to you that when I was in my teens, and I never ran riot, I never went wild, but I have to admit that in my teens there were times when I just found being brought up in a Christian home a wee bit restrictive. Tuesday night was the meeting night. Tuesday night was youth club. And I lived in the school where the youth club was held. I used to tell everybody, you know, that my father was in education. He was actually the school caretaker. But you know, that's besides the point. Tuesday night, youth club. Tuesday night, the ministry meeting. And I'm going to be honest with you. If my mother and father had said to me, "No, look, you can choose tonight whether you go to youth club or you go to the ministry meeting," I would have gone to the youth club. And I did find it sometimes a little restrictive. I couldn't go where my friends were going. I couldn't do some of the things that they were doing. I wanted to. I wasn't allowed. And there were just times when I found it a little restrictive. Am I speaking to somebody this afternoon and that's where you're at? That to you, it's not quite the privilege that I'm trying to make out that it is. That you yourself are finding it now just, it's clipping your wings a bit. Your friends seem to have so much more fun than you. They seem to have much more liberty than you. They can do what they want and you can. You didn't really want to be here this afternoon, did you? Look, I'm not being critical. I've sat where you're now sitting. I'm just appealing to you. One night I sat in a room in front of a young lad, he was 17. And his mother had contacted me because he didn't want to go to the meetings. So I arranged to meet the boy. And I sat down in front of him and I said to him, "Tell me, what's the problem?" This is what he said. He said, "I love the world. And I want to see what it's got to offer." I'll never forget that night. Because that young lad was my son. I said to him, "Hugh, are you saved?" And it may be there's someone in the room tonight and you are conforming and you're coming to the meeting simply to appease your parents. I'm appealing to you. We were praying at the breakfast table, or at least the couple I was staying with was praying at the breakfast table this morning, that maybe at one of these conferences in Scotland there might be somebody that would get saved. I tell you, this meeting has that potential. Not because the speakers are anything. The power lies in the word and not in the man. This afternoon I want to ask you, as I asked my son 20 years ago, are you saved? And if you're not, you can get saved right now. There is a sequel to that story. 6 years later, I sat in the kitchen with that same young man, my son. And in his words, not mine, having gone into the world and done what all teenagers do, and a lot more that I don't know anything about, at the age of 23, in his words, he said, "Dad, I find far greater pleasure in my church than I ever found in the world." You see, the Bible speaks about the pleasures of sin. I know I'm going off piste a bit here, but just bear with me. The Bible speaks about the pleasures of sin, but they are limited. They are for a season. On the 28th of October 1949, a 22-year-old American boy wrote in his diary these words, and you will have heard them. "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Young people, I wasted so many years of my teenage life. I wish I could recall them now. and I'm asking and I'm appealing. Instead of chafing and finding family life restrictive, you give God thanks for godly parents that have a spiritual interest in you. And I'm asking you, in the words of the old chorus, turn your eyes upon Jesus. And the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. A divided home. I want to think with you now about his delicate health. And I want to read some scriptures to you. Don't turn to them. I just want to read them. And I want to ask you to do something. As I read to you these scriptures, I want you to ask yourself the question, do these scriptures paint the picture of the kind of young man that the world considers to be somebody worth following? Do these verses paint the ideal picture of the world's young man? Listen to them. No longer drink water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. Now, if Timotheus come, see that he may be with you without fear. Greatly is his desiring to see thee, being mindful of thy tears. I would also judge, although the Bible doesn't tell us, but I would also judge that Timothy was not married. I don't think Timothy could have gone on Paul's second missionary journey, his third missionary journey, been sent to Ephesus, sent to Corinth, and eventually called to Rome if he'd been a married man. So we put all these scriptures together, and what kind of profile does it give us of this young man? It paints a picture of a young man that was delicate, frequently ill, emotional, anxious, timid. The very opposite of what this world would consider a young man to be. Doesn't paint a very great picture, does it? The world looks for young men that are popular. It looks for young people that are macho. It looks for young people who want to get on. They're competitive. They're intellectual. They're progressive. And the world is looking for people who are self-assured. I want to tell you that Timothy did not fit the bill at all. Now look. I've got no doubt that Timothy grew up with many young men that fitted the world's ideal of what a young person should be. I want to ask you something. How many of them can you name? Isn't it strange this afternoon that in a town 2,000 miles from where Timothy grew up, and separated by 2,000 years in round figures, this afternoon we're not talking about this young man's contemporaries, we're talking about Timothy. A man who the world would have discounted. When you come to Luke chapter 3, the gospel writer opens chapter 3 and in 1.5 verses presents to us the names of the 7 most important men in the world at that time. 7 of them. And in 1.5 verses, the Spirit of God dispenses with the 7. And then for 18.5 verses, the Spirit of God speaks about a strange fella. We know him as John the Baptist. I want to appeal particularly to younger ones again, but the point is this. Heaven assesses people by a totally different set of values than earth. And I'm asking all of us now, because it impacts on all ages, by whose set of values do we want to be judged? And more importantly, fellow saint, by whose set of values are we aiming at? You know, I have found 2 Timothy extremely challenging. I don't know about Andrew, but I have found it frighteningly challenging. Tonight we're going to look at some of the things that God asked Timothy to do. Remember, this is a man that's constantly ill. In the eyes of the world, a pathetic character. Jack Hunter, a name that will mean quite a bit to older ones in the room, used to come to Wales a lot. And he frequently used to quote the lines written by a man called C.T. Studd, Charles Studd. And C.T. Studd wrote, "Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last." Will you forgive another personal illustration? I had no intention of saying it. At the age of 34, I sat in front of a doctor and she said, "You may have cancer." And the tears rolled down my face. The primary cause of those tears is that I had three sons and the oldest was only four. And I could not bear to think that my sons would grow up and not know their dad. I was no hero. Trust me. I just broke down. But there was something else that was really biting at my heart. I was 34. And the thing that bothered me, fellow saint, is what have I done for God? It didn't matter to me at that moment whether Glamorgan won the county championship or whether Wales stuffed Scotland at Murrayfield. Those things no longer seemed important. They really didn't. The only thing that mattered is that I might be going out. Well, what am I taking with me? I'm 67 and the challenge is still there to me today. What have I done with my time? Let me tell you a little bit more about C.T. Studd. He went to Eton. He graduated from Cambridge. Played cricket for England. Played in the first Ashes series in 1881. This is the world's idea of what a man should be. And that's what Studd wrote. Only one life. It will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. I want to ask you, which world, fellow saint, all of us in the meeting now will be living for? This one or the one to come? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the world think of you. At the end of the day, it'll only matter what Christ thinks. As we stand before him at the judgment seat, that's all that will matter. I'm not saying that education, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's wrong to get on in this world. You appreciate that, don't you? Thank God for men that are intelligent and hold high positions. I'm just trying to get the point over that there needs to be a prioritizing in our lives. But one more point on Timothy's delicate health. It's a subject in itself. Just give me 1 minute. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. Timothy chose to abstain from alcohol. And he chose to do so at the cost of his own health. And when Paul exhorts him, "Timothy, you can use a little," will you notice the terminology that Paul uses? He speaks about drinking water, but he says about using wine. And then further to qualify it, he says, "Use a little wine." I want to suggest to you that Timothy deliberately abstained from alcohol because he was in Ephesus. And I think there was a drink problem in Ephesus. For it's only in the Ephesian epistle do you get the exhortation, be not drunk with wine. Now look, we could spend the rest of this session on this. There is enough warning in the scriptures, fellow saint, about alcohol to cause me to choose not to drink. And I want to say this to those of you who are parents. You might feel at liberty to have a glass of wine. But remember that you're influencing the family in your home. That son that I've told you about said to me only a few years ago, he said, I was going through my bank statements, Dad, he said. In those years, he said, when I was away, he said, you would not believe how many thousands of pounds I spent on alcohol. Me and my wife are not the perfect parents. Trust me. I wish I could wind the clock back and do a few things differently to what I did. But one thing I thank God for is that none of my sons ever, ever, ever learned to drink in my home. I just leave it with you. Finally, I want to think with you of his developing holiness. And again, we have to be selective in the scriptures that we read or consider. I want to think of the very beginning of his life. And I'm in 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 15, and we'll deal with this tomorrow. From a child, thou hast known the holy scriptures. From an infant, who taught Timothy those holy letters? Who? Not his father. His father was a Greek. It was his mother. I want to appeal to you mothers in the room this afternoon. We are living in an age when motherhood is seen as something secondary. It's been downgraded. I had a haircut this past week, not that you wanted to know. But while I was sitting there waiting for my turn, I picked up the newspaper and I was reading about a couple, many of you will have known their names. And they've been married for 19 years. He was a footballer, she was a singer. And after 19 years, they've just got divorced because she just felt trapped in a marriage that was hindering her career progress. They've got a child of 13. And a child of 9. And motherhood, if I might use that antiquated expression, is being seen today as something, you know, that's a hindrance to the career progress. I appeal to you mothers this afternoon, your greatest vocation in life is to raise a family for God. It really is. Oh, says John, I have no greater joy. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. Can I appeal to grandmothers as well? And I speak as a grandparent. You know, we should take a full interest in every aspect of our children's lives. To be all spiritual is utterly imbalanced. We want to raise children that will become fully rounded adults. So you take an interest in their schooling, and you take an interest in their free time, and you play with them as a dad and as a mom. But that your noblest vocation is to educate them in spiritual things, just like a Rebecca did to Jacob, just like a Jochebed did to Moses, just like a Hannah did to Samuel. You know, when you read the history of the kings of Israel, very often you'll come across this expression, and his mother's name was. I tell you, dear sister, be you a mother or a grandmother, you can have a massive, massive influence. They used to say, didn't they, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. I'm just appealing to mothers and grandmothers in the meeting this afternoon. Teach your children spiritual things. You know, I thought it was tough when our boys were going to school. I feel desperately sorry for parents today. My oldest granddaughter, Saren, is 9. And they have been, well, in the school, thankfully, she's gone to a Welsh school. I don't mean it's in Wales, it is a Welsh school. And thankfully, the head of the school is a Christian, I would judge. But you know, our young people in junior schools and in secondary schools today have been taught things that we wouldn't have believed even 15 years ago. Where are those children going to get the foundation and the bedrock to help them to see the wrong of what they have been taught is right? They're going to get it from their mother, and they're going to get it from their father, and they're going to get it at home. Not from the local education authority. From a child. As an infant, Timothy was taught the Holy Scriptures. But then when you come to 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 2, Paul says unto Timothy, my own son in the faith. There came a time when Timothy got saved. Now I remember the time when a boy said to me, he says, Dad, I want to get saved. Probably the grandest words that son will ever say to me. Timothy got saved under the preaching of the Apostle Paul. And I want to say as parents now, what a joy it is to know that all the family is saved. But there will be parents in this room this afternoon, and the family are not all saved. And like you, I know what it is to shed more than one tear. Salvation doesn't run in the genes. The fact that you teach your children the scriptures, the fact that you bring them to the meetings, the fact you seek to set a good example before them, is no guarantee that they're going to be saved. I want to say tenderly and kindly, the fact that your children are not saved does not mean that you've been a bad parent. There's many a parent who's got children tonight out in the world. For those of us who, by God's wondrous, matchless grace, has worked in our family and we've seen the children saved, may we spare a thought for parents who are not in that position. And instead of criticizing them, just remember them in prayer. And if you do have a child, a son or a daughter, no matter what age, and tonight they still not say, don't give up. And continue to pray. But the day came when Timothy got saved. And Paul says, you're my own true child. My son in the faith. But then we come to Acts 16 and we read these words about Timothy. Then came he to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timotheus, which was well reported of by the brethren that were at Lystra and Iconium. Him would Paul have to go forth with him. Listen, the gap between Timothy getting saved and Acts 16 is less than 6 years. I want to make a point here. In less than 6 years, Timothy got saved. He got baptized. He came into assembly fellowship. He started to take part in the meetings. He began to develop gift. He was not only a help and a benefit to his home assembly at Lystra, but he began to be a help to an assembly down the road in Iconium. And by the time Paul gets there, Paul thinks that this young man is now ready to go into full-time service, all fellow saint, in less than 6 years. I tell you, I find that humbling. I didn't match up to that. 6 years after I was saved, I was still spiritually a pygmy. You know, it says he was a disciple, he was a learner. He didn't just pitch up at the meetings. He came to learn. He was a follower. He was a participant. I remember when the children were born. I remember when the grandchildren were born. What a tremendous delight it is, you know, when your child utters their first words. It's brilliant. Or when your grandchildren do the same thing. When they take their first tottering step and, you know, you're encouraging them to stop crawling and begin to take their first step. And, you know, within a matter of moments, they're flat on their face. But it's brilliant and you delight in it and it thrills you. But go back 10 years later. And if your child is still trying to utter their first words and still trying to take their first step, how sad. We can relate this now, can't we, to the spiritual dimension of life. I want to ask us all, another year is finished. What progress are we making in our Christian life? And you know, sometimes I think that we give the young people short shrift and we hammer the young people. Young people, what are you doing with your life? What about my generation? I think there's a real danger that my generation can just plateau. I really do. And I hear brethren saying, we're either moving forward or we're moving back spiritually. Well, maybe they're right, but I'm not convinced. I actually think it's possible to stand still. And I think too many of us are just doing that. We're treading water. We're standing still. How thrilling it is when you see a young person beginning to develop and beginning to mature. And I appeal to you young people, you know, overseers should be looking out for these things and encouraging and stimulating. But how thrilling it is to find older people still with a thirst for the things of God. I remember being in a meeting up in East Anglia where this chap comes from. And there was a sister sat in the seat there. And I don't know how old she was, but she was probably well into her 70s, if not older. And she was taking notes right through the meeting. I thought, what an absolute gem. The point I want to make is that Timothy developed and progressed. And I want to ask this afternoon, all of us, what about me? Finally, Paul sends Timothy to Corinth. He says, for this cause I sent unto you Timotheus, who is my beloved son and faithful in the Lord, who shall bring you into remembrance of my ways which be in Christ. How could Paul, on what basis could Paul select Timothy to send him to Ephesus and to Corinth and to other assemblies, to Thessalonica? What was the criteria that Paul used? I'll tell you what it was. I have no man like-minded who will genuinely care for your state. For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ's, but he know the proof of him. Brethren and sisters, I want to appeal to those who are overseers. I want to appeal to those who are Bible teachers. Paul could send Timothy because Timothy had a love for the people of God. I can come to Aberdeen, trust me, this is true. I can come to Aberdeen and fumble my way through a meeting of this nature because there's something about it that appeals to my ego. If you think that's exaggerating, you don't know the wickedness of my own heart. What we need as overseers and as teachers, what we need amongst us is men like Timothy who had a care for the people of God. Overseers are called shepherds, not sheepdogs. A sheepdog only knows how to correct. But a sheepdog is no use when an ewe is lambing. And a sheepdog is no use when a lamb is sick. All a sheepdog can do is correct. Overseers, and I'm trying to be funny now, overseers are not called sheepdogs, they're called shepherds. When David sinned, there was pretty much any man in Jerusalem that God could have sent up to the palace to put him right. Pretty much. But God chooses a man called Nathan. And he goes up to the palace and there's David on the throne. And David's enemies have been subjugated. And David's at the pinnacle of his career. And this man starts to tell a story. Just told a story. About somebody that had one ewe lamb. And down the road there was somebody that had plenty of sheep. But that person had a visitor. And instead of taking one of his flock, he went and took the one ewe lamb that this fella had. And took it home and killed it. And gave lamb chops to his visitor. Strange sort of story. Why do you think Naboth bothered to do that? Because sat on the throne in all his regal splendor, having triumphed over his foes, sat on that throne that day was a man in whose breast beat the heart of a shepherd. And nothing would touch the heart of David more than the story of one ewe lamb. We need men like that. Men like Timothy. We tried in a very feeble and in a very vague way to size up this man of God. His contemporaries are dead and forgotten. The memory of the just is blessed. This afternoon, fellow saint, no matter what age we are, may we feel something of the challenge. In total, all we get is 20 years of Timothy's life, that's all. Just 20. From the time of his conversion to being the last person that Paul wrote to. What a development. What progress. What about me?